Welcome to the Occupational Safety Leadership Podcast, episode number 3 with Sean Galloway of PROAC Safety. Okay, we have Sean Galloway from PROAC Safety joining us today to talk about safety culture. Sean, could you spend a couple of minutes and tell us about yourself and your company before we get started?
Sure, Dave, I appreciate that. So again, Sean Galloway, my firm is PROAC Safety. We were established in 1993 by Terry Mathis, who served as the CEO until his retirement last year. And I joined the company in 2005, became president in 2009, and CEO with Terry's departure and retirement last year. We've always really focused on what we call the four core components of safety excellence. So safety excellence is where we concentrate our energy, and those four core components, the things you have to be great at to achieve and sustain and keep pushing the envelope around safety excellence, is strategy. A lot of organizations don't have an effective strategy, throw a bunch of programs at problems, hoping bad things are going to go away.
Exactly.
So being strategic and having a good strategy. The other piece is culture. Despite strategy, you also have to have a strategy to affect the culture and to leverage the positive aspects. So it can't just be all about injury prevention. You have to have a strategy around your culture too. So we like to say everybody has a culture, or a safety culture, if you will, but it just may not be the one that you want. But realistically, safety is just a part of your occupational culture. So you have to look at it in whole, not just the safety piece to it. And the third is leadership, making sure that people know their most important environmental health and safety, or just safety roles and responsibilities. We're moving the leadership role in the organization away from just policing for compliance to really coaching for performance. So helping those leaders see themselves as actors in that safety strategy and having real operational ownership. So it's not just Dave and Sean, the safety guys, are going to be the ones doing this. And then that fourth piece is engagement, tapping into that discretionary effort, the whole want to versus have to culture with this, that we learned this a long time ago. Employees can obey the rules, follow all the procedures, wear all their personal protective equipment, and still get injured. So it's not just do as I say, it's tapping into that motivation and creating that level of discretionary engagement. But we find that those are the four things companies need to be great at. And that's where we spend a lot of our time writing and speaking and, of course, advising organizations.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I know that when I was a young safety professional, I really focused on the hard skills, and I wish I'd focused a lot more on the soft skills. I was very into OSHA says the following, and while I did pretty good, I found that the more I kind of focused on my soft skills, engaged with people, really kind of sat down and said, let's see exactly what's going on. I started to make a lot more progress. What would you say to the safety professional who's kind of coming out of school and kind of trying to figure out, so how do I engage the workforce in a really meaningful way?
Yeah, Dave, I view that EHS safety professionals have to have both the technical acumen, but also have to have the leadership acumen. And a lot of people spend their time and energy, as they should, on the technical piece, because we do want those subject matter expertise or those centers of excellence within organizations where we have a true process safety management expert, if we have covered processes and everything. But you're right, and I found the same thing. So I come from a military background, and then when I first got into safety in the mid to late 90s, process safety management had been out for a few years. So PSM fit me really well coming from the military, mm-hmm. where I'm used to somebody says left face, we all go left. Somebody says about face, we all turn around. We're used to that type of stuff.
Right,
so
right.
I too thought of it as, you know, just if people could follow the rules. And then when I thought about that piece beyond that, the soft piece, I was naively back in the late 90s and early 2000s thinking, well, it has to do with just getting people to care. And I remember around the same time, I think it was, I was reading The Essential Drucker, and I think I may have read this in there where Drucker said, it's not enough. Peter Drucker said, it's not enough to try your best. You have to first know what to do and then try your best. So in 2005, when I joined PROAC, I was recruited to come into the firm. We had a project, and this experience has stuck with me. So this leader wanted to change the culture. And of course, I'm being mentored by Terry Mathis at the time on this, and I'm changing and maturing my mindset around safety, just coming about it from a technical compliance perspective. But if we get people to care, well, this individual's name was Henry, and he was the executive vice president of operations for this massive corporation. And he was the one that wanted to change the culture, but he also knew that line leadership owned it. Back to what I said earlier, not the Daves and the Seans owning it. So he was the right person to lead this job. He cared a lot about safety, which is what I thought the soft part was. A few weeks after we started working with his company, we found out that he got up in the middle of the night and had to use a restroom. And he didn't see the magazine on his carpeted bedroom floor. And when he slipped on that magazine, he hit his head on the nightstand, but went to the restroom and back to sleep, not realizing he was internally hemorrhaging. And he passed away that night. We think the same thing happened months ago to Bob Saget from Full House. But it's to answer your question, the people coming right out of school or right after getting certified in something, you have to be able to explain the value in helping people to see why we do the things that we do in safety. Because at home, we're much more likely to get injured than we are at work to begin with. But it's more than just having an attitude about safety or getting people to care about its importance. It really comes down to overly simplistic. Safety is knowing what can hurt you, knowing the things to do to keep those things from hurting you, and then regularly doing those things. So a compliance, the technical piece, all of those are wildly important. But I find one of the biggest contributing factors to why we don't get the support from people as safety professionals, whether that support is the employee doing more than checking a box to get that paperwork turned in, or the leader providing resources and capital to get things done. I find the biggest contributing factor of why we don't get that is because they don't see the value. And that's our role as safety professionals, is not only to make sure what we're doing is of value, but to make sure that people see the value of the things that we're doing. And we can be great, have all the technical stuff, but if they see us as a nuisance, or even better, a necessary evil to get the business done, we're not going to get where we're trying to go. So a lot of it has to do with us helping people see why we do the things that we do. And that is that soft piece, because I've, like you, I'm sure, known a lot of people that really care. I know safety professionals, people that I've developed friendship with over the years in my profession, who have lost their life to accidental death in and around the homes, but they were super dedicated to safety. So it really comes down to helping us apply the technical know-how, but having people have a real sense of ownership and understanding the why behind the things that we're doing.
It's funny how that you bring up things there like leadership and the army, because I came up that same way. So as soon as I was out of school, I was like, well, I was in the army, I can lead anybody anywhere. Of course, I'm an expert at that stuff. Everybody will follow me. There's not anybody who's going to ever question why they're doing something. And then it kind of hit me that, well, if I don't sit down and really tell them why, they're always going to question why they're ever doing anything. And it doesn't even have to do with safety. It could just be anything in life. If I can't really honestly sit down and talk to them about it, they're going to have doubts. They're not going to have that buy-in as if they should, and all that stuff too then. So yes.
John Cotter out of Harvard said that there are three things that trigger people to resist change. And before I mention that, we found in our research and thousands of experiences that people don't actually naturally just by default resist change. And I know that's different than what you've experienced and perhaps the listeners of this. But the thing is, people change all the time. It's not the change that people resist, it's the force of being changed. And that's why we teach force change is almost always temporary, because when you and the force go away, so does the change. So if people see the value, back to that value proposition, if they see the value and how it benefits them or those they care about, they're more likely. But Cotter says there are three things that trigger people to resist change. Number one, they don't understand it. And communication is very difficult for all of us to get right in our personal and professional lives. And we also do a much better job as humans aligning others to our results expectations than we do our behavioral expectations. And that's a whole nother piece, but they don't understand the why behind it. Number two and three are interesting because they don't like the change or they don't like who's bringing it. And his research and a lot of others show that people respond emotionally to change before they respond logically. And I find that it's hilarious that Harvard probably spent millions to arrive at that conclusion. And there's a quote by Dale Carnegie in 1919 where he said, "Never forget when dealing with the human species, we're dealing with an emotional species, not a logical one." And that goes back to your opening question about helping people understand why we do what we do and how it benefits them personally. And I would even add to that, that I find the most important thing to most people are their family. And I challenge leaders all the time in workshops and working with them. I challenge them to think about three people they'd like to influence. Picture their faces, think of their names. And then I challenge them and I say, don't respond to me, but can you name the family members of those three people? And the argument I make is, if you can, maybe you've created the perception with them that you care enough about them to know who's important. If you can't, maybe unintentionally, you've created the perception you don't care enough about them to know who's important. And when we can help people connect their personal values with the values we're trying to instill at work, it's an easier road ahead. But that goes back to the understanding the why, not just, I said we're going to take Hill 223, go take Hill 223.
Right. I think that anytime that somebody sits down and thinks about change, you bring up a very interesting point about where that change is from. So I do an awful lot of chemical safety, and it's really easy to sit down and say, well, the research shows the following, and they'll just look at you like, okay, it says the following, and you know, and they, it just doesn't dawn on them. But when they figure out the research and bring it to you, those guys cannot order enough gloves fast enough and goggles and everything else. So if they have the change, if they take the ownership, it's a whole lot easier. And I also like that point that you brought up about knowing the family members. I've worked at a lot of places for a long time. And at some point in time, I really did start to know all the folks there and a lot of if they were married and had kids. And of course, you'd hear them talk about their problems in the hallways and all that kind of stuff. Then it was really a whole lot easier to break down those barriers to understand that we're all humans. We all have pretty much the same problems out there. We all have the same kind of motivations, too. You could take the most person, the hardest ass who will not change at all. But if they're a football fan and you talk about football, you've now broken down that barrier right from the get-go, and they're a little more apt to hearing what you're saying because, you know, now it's not coming from like the safety guy who's just really awful and he's hard on everybody and all that. It's another football guy, just sitting down talking like guys, you know.
You know, it's we're trying to get people to do what you'd like for them to do for their own benefit, so that's hard. But even in recognizing people, you need to know what's important to people. What motivates you, Dave, may demotivate me and vice versa.
Right.
And even in recognizing if I don't, I'm one of those crazy people. I like to be up on a stage in front of people and everything. But a lot of people, you bring them up on stage to celebrate them in front of their peers, they may work to not get that recognition. But on your piece, so I want to come back to that if I may, but on your piece about helping them understand it, there's a quote by Deming, Dr. W. Edwards Deming, served me well in my career, but he taught that people support what they help to create. And that's that real ownership piece.
Yes.
But also, I want to highlight the importance of what you said of knowing where the change is coming from. I was with the plant management team, is it yesterday? Yeah, yesterday. I flew home. I fly all the time, so I forget where I am sometimes. I'm in Houston today. But I was with this plant management team. I'm sorry, it was 2 days ago. And we were talking about some of the changes that are coming down from corporate. And the plant managers were sharing with me that some of their workers, it seems that they feel that all management does is sit behind an office and say, how can we make their job harder today? You know, some of these changes are from the regulatory agencies. Some of those are corporate. Some of those are industry best practices that if we don't adopt, we're not going to compete. But a lot of companies I find, sometimes it's not practical, but don't have the ability or take the time to help people really understand how decisions are made. And some of these decisions we do want some ownership in, but some of those we don't have a choice. If we don't do that, we're going to lose our license to operate. But back on the knowing people, a story that I tell often is I was on a train 10, 11 years ago, going from Lucerne to back to Zurich, went over to see the Lions at Lucerne one weekend when I was working over in Europe. And I'm on this train and I hear this family with a Southern dialect sounding a lot like me coming from Houston. And I had to introduce myself. It was Cindy Zane and their 12-year-old daughter at the time. I'm still friends with them today. But she was the head of HR for one of the largest oil field services companies based here in Houston. They were living in Cairo, which is where she was officed at, and they were on a vacation in Switzerland. So we became fast friends because she was doing a lot of stuff around culture like I do. So she told me the story that months prior, she was in Houston at an awards gala where basically the leaders are celebrating each other. And she's sitting at this round table about to be brought up on stage to receive this recognition. And the executives going over all the stuff she did and ended with, and in order for Cindy to be able to accomplish all this for us last year, she had to be on the road 215 days. Can you believe it? Gave her a round of applause. And she told me the only thing that I heard was I was away from my daughter for 215 days last year. They were on their final vacation because she had accepted a lower position back in Houston that didn't require her to travel anymore. Right. And that executive was trying to do the right thing, but going back to knowing your people, unfortunately, you know, made a faux pas a little bit just because he was trying to celebrate and recognize her, but didn't know what was important to her.
Yes. I've known a bunch of folks that will never raise their hand in a meeting, but they'll catch you in the hallway and talk to you and say, you know, I didn't want to say anything in public because I might look awful. You know, I don't want anybody else to think I'm going to get somebody in trouble, but I'd like to address the following safety issues. So some people are very comfortable in public and talking and speaking up, whereas others will never say a word and they will only talk to you one-on-one when they know that nobody else will hear.
Dave, that goes back to the stuff we've been talking about here. What motivates one person demotivates another, but those soft skills of knowing people do things for a reason. And if you don't understand the reason, you're never going to help them do what you need them to do or advise them to go in that direction. And if the last few times they've spoken up, either bad things have happened or it's one of those, anybody have any questions or we can finish this shift and go home, nobody wants to speak up. So there's often, you know, reasons behind that. And it's not that we have people that aren't doing what we need them to do. There are reasons behind that. And if we're not trying to understand those influences on behavior, then we're never going to truly get to us being great. And that's my company. We focus on business excellence through safety excellence. So we help organizations strive and complete and get on that journey around safety excellence. And then the rest of the business starts to realize, hey, we could use some of that over there. And EHS starts to be perceived as a true business partner and innovator because we're doing all this great stuff, especially companies that are really investing in their leaders from a safety standpoint.
Right.
As you and I know, not a lot of companies are investing in their leaders like they used to be of times of past.
Right.
So
right.
When EHS starts to do it and starts developing those soft skills, hey, why don't we use that some of that over here? And safety leads the way.
Yes. It does a very good job of helping that leader to go up to that next level, because we can talk about things like accidents, risk, and cost, but until that person actually experiences it, it's all just theory. It's all just, well, I've done this a million times and I've never gotten hurt. But now that they could be in charge, they now start to look at those things like, well, you know, I did a couple of unsafe things too. So now I need to go back and jazz up myself and make sure that others are doing that as well. So you can find where some leaders were not very good when they worked on the factory floor, but you put them in the right spot and then they kind of see the big picture, like, whoa, I've really been doing a lot of awful things, and they're not really sure how they never got hurt. But it kind of turns on that light switch for them. So
you know, you're getting me to think about something. So I live in Houston, as I mentioned, had a lot of water related events with hurricanes and everything, but February 21, pipes burst and everything with the freeze that we had down here. And Texas has its own energy grid. And there was a lot of discussion around the concerns. And like a lot of things, memory's short and it's no longer kind of point of conversation. So a lot of us in Texas are concerned about the future. But I bring this up because we tend to have, I think our short-term memory about some of these problems and how we've solved them is going to continue to be an issue going forward. I say that because when COVID came about, which is still a touchy subject for a lot of us, but when COVID came about, EHS professionals were all of a sudden seen as business advisors, business continuity advisors. And a lot of them have been striving for that proverbial seat or real seat at the table, but weren't strategic thinkers enough, didn't really understand business and how to talk to business leaders beyond just the technical piece. But all of a sudden, they were thrust in that position to help keep the business open. So they were seen as strategic allies. And I feel as though that there were a lot of companies that the EHS professional benefited from all of a sudden being a key partner and ally to how do we sustain our operations and prevent, bad things from happening with this. I hope that those companies will continue to revisit the role that the safety professionals played in that and continue to be viewed as those business advisors, which makes the things that we're doing a lot easier to be understood versus, no burning platform, everything must be good. And that's something that I really hope continues. And I've been saying this for a long time that, if an EHS professional cannot develop a strategy, which is where business leaders all have to develop a market-facing strategy, then they're going to be viewed as that necessary evil or subject matter expert we lean on from time to time. But I sure hope that that's not lost with how short-term our memory happens to be about some of these events, because it would be missed opportunity if so.
Oh yes. I think that even though that COVID was really awful for most people, in the safety aspect, it really propelled us forward. As you were saying, it really kind of shined a light. We started to talk about things that we had never talked about before, like that we're going to talk about hygiene inside the office. Before we had talked about, well, if you're out on the floor, we're going to wipe down our desks after work. We're going to check for lead, and all that kind of stuff. But nobody had ever thought about, so what do we do about somebody potentially having COVID inside the office? Because of course, some people had signs and symptoms. Others didn't. It was really kind of a very difficult animal to get a hold of.
And with that, I think there was some benefit. I still think that some companies, many that I know, that took a few steps back because those safety professionals have been working for a long time to no longer be perceived as, pardon the term, safety cop, safety police. And then all of a sudden they became the COVID cops. They were out there
Oh,
enforcing
yes.
masks and enforcing distance and enforcing all of this stuff. And I've seen this in many organizations that the perception of the role of that safety professional unfortunately has stepped back a little bit, and they're having to kind of regain that ground and rebuild those relationships, especially with communication. A lot of companies relied way too much on mass email communication and the stuff like you and I are doing. It's even virtual and not in person, so
Right, right,
you're
right,
missing
right.
that opportunity to build relationships.
Right. Email is a fantastic tool, but you have to have somebody actually open up the email, read it, understand it, and then execute it, as opposed to, well, I sent it to them and that counts as communication. I mean, it really doesn't. Anytime that you have communication, and even face-to-face communication, humans are not always good at that whole thing.
Nope.
Face-to-face, like you and me, is pretty good now, but it still is not the same as the same room. So,
George Bernard Shaw, the Irish playwright, said the
yes,
single biggest problem in communication is the illusion that it's taken place. Sent the
exactly.
email.
Exactly. All right. I see that we're getting a little short on time here, Sean. So I like to shift gears. I didn't even cover a quarter of what I wanted to talk about. So hopefully we'll do a part two, three, and four in the future. But just to kind of round out today's episode, if you could just kind of spend a couple seconds and tell us what your definition of a safety professional is.
A safety professional is an advisor, a coach, a trainer, an educator, all around the topics of how do we identify and prevent risk from entering into the organization and hurting someone. We know we can't engineer all risks out of the equation, so it's to be a subject matter expert on all the things that could hurt people, helping leaders and all the employees within understand what to do to mitigate those risks and to keep yourself distance from harm, and then develop systems of control systems, but also systems of influence, to try to nudge the organization forward to developing the capacity to be able to deal with hazards and risks in the organization, but also the capacity to respond when events do occur. And I think that's one of the roles of safety professional going forward in the future, is to help us evolve past the mindset that all events are preventable. You know, humans make mistakes. Mistakes are normal in complex environments. So our role is to build that system capacity, while also by also educating and continuously maturing the thinking around what safety is and what it isn't, and what excellence in safety is and what excellence isn't.
Exactly, exactly. A lot of companies have excellence counts as nobody was hurt. And I'm sure that I could have my eyes closed and walk across a busy street, and most of the time people will stop for me. You know, I didn't do anything to actually prevent it, but luckily somebody stopped in time. Before that we go, how can people connect with you also? Let's talk about that for a few seconds.
Yeah, I've been on all the platforms for a long time. So I'm on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all of those. I also started the first safety podcast back in January 2008. So over 700 topics now.
Oh, that's called awesome.
Safety Culture Excellence. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you can find me on LinkedIn, anywhere else. If you look up my name in safety, you'll easily find. And I'd welcome to connect. I love to engage and have conversations like I'm having with you, Dave.
Fantastic, Sean. Thank you so much. And I'm going to have to look at having you back on for part 2, 3, and 4, and maybe even a 5 and 6 if we just keep on talking. So I had started this whole thing as a very selfish motivation, just to learn more from others out there. And so this has really been a great thing for me to learn, of course, obviously also at the same time. So thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate it.
Okay. Have yourself a great day. Thanks, Sean. See ya.
Bye-bye.